Welcome to this special edition of Voices, featuring a presentation from the 2009 Camden Conference. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of this year's Camden Conference, the 22nd such conference held here in Midcoast, Maine, was Global Leadership and the U.S. Role in World Affairs. On today's program, Nicholas Burns reflects on a new era of diplomacy for the Obama administration. Suppose that tomorrow morning you got a call from the new president, Barack Obama. And suppose he said something like, "You know, we've necessarily been concentrating on the great economic crisis that faces us here at home, but now it's time to turn our attention outward and look at what faces us in foreign policy. And I'd like to know what you think are our greatest opportunities and greatest challenges." What would you tell him? That's exactly the challenge that Nicholas Burns, a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, set for himself at the Camden Conference, and he met the challenge admirably. Here's conference moderator Graham Faup introducing Nicholas Burns.
Nicholas Burns. He is currently Professor of Practice and Diplomacy and International Politics at the Kennedy School in Harvard. He retired from the State Department in April 2008 after a distinguished career spanning 27 years. He served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, where he led U.S. negotiations with countries such as Iran, India, and Kosovo, and supervised U.S. diplomacy in all regions of the world. Prior to that, Nick was U.S. Ambassador to NATO and to Greece. He served as State Department spokesman for 2 years and spent 5 years on the White House staff as special assistant to the president, with primary focus upon the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's also, if that's not enough, he's also on the boards of the Atlantic Council, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Appeal of Conscience, and is a proud member of the Red Sox Nation. So he's come to the right place. Nicholas also shared with me that we share a second name in Robert, and so he really is Robert Burns, our national bird from Scotland, and so he's a man after my ain heart. Nicholas's subject this morning is a new era of diplomacy for the Obama administration. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Burns to the podium.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Graham, thanks very much. We just celebrated the 250th anniversary of Robert Burns' birth on January 26th. I did have haggis, I told you that day, and some scotch. It's a pleasure to be with all of you here in Camden, this beautiful opera house, on a beautiful morning. My task is to speak about American foreign policy moving forward. So what is Obama going to face as he looks out in the world after his first 30 days? I'll try to do that briefly because, like General Scowcroft last evening, I thought the question and answer period with him was really just brilliant and interesting. And I thought he was brilliant. I worked for him 20 years ago when he was National Security Advisor. I worked for the first President Bush, as Graham said, in the Soviet Union. And I thought that we heard a lot of wisdom last night from General Scowcroft. I cannot promise you any wisdom from me. He's a singularly unique and experienced and wise person, I think. The only person to have been National Security Advisor twice. And most people would say he wrote the record of how to be a National Security Advisor. And what struck me about his remarks, I was thinking about it this morning when I was trying to reflect what I should say, was how he emphasized change and transition. And we do live in an incredible period of change, if you think about it. And he intimated this last night. We have been moving from the industrial age to the global age. We don't really have a good name for it, the age of globalization. We're trying to move, because we're concerned about climate change, from a carbon-based economy to something different, or carbon-reduced, or perhaps even at some point in the future, a carbon-free society. We're certainly living in an age when the United States, while still the dominant country on the international scene, has to share that power now, really for the first time in a very long time, first time since the end of the Second World War, with lots of other countries in the world. And we're living at a time when we're at one of those periods where the international system needs to be reconstructed. And I think that's what Brent was trying to say last night. Most of the institutions that form the backbone and the structure of the international system are old, and they were created for a different world, the world of the immediate post-war period, 1945 to 1949. And if you think about it, we've had about three of these periods of reconstruction, renewal, and change in the last 100 years. We had this opportunity in 1918 and 1919, four empires that collapsed. And Woodrow Wilson went to Versailles with big ambitions. And if you've read Margaret Macmillan's fantastic book, Paris 1919, she details the opportunity that the world had and how we squandered it, particularly we Americans, when we did not join the League of Nations. And we subsequently saw the rise of the fascist powers and inherited the Second World War. We had a second opportunity, and it went much better between 1945 and 1949 because men like, and women, but men like Roosevelt, FDR, and Marshall, who had been younger serving officials in 1919, saw the mistakes that had been made. They had an enemy in front of them. Certainly Marshall and Truman did, the Soviet Union, which concentrated their minds, and they made great decisions and then followed through when they created the United Nations and the IMF and the World Bank, as Brent suggested last night, and NATO, and the coal and steel community that became the common market and then the European Union. And we constructed a peace and then a strategy to preserve the peace through containment that held for 45 to 50 years. We made good decisions. And we had the patience and long-term vision that Obama's been talking about that we certainly need. We had it back then. So the question, I think, for this conference, in a way, is what are we Americans going to make of this third opportunity? Because we know that the institutions that we have been relying upon for peace and security are sagging and weakening. And they're no longer up to the challenge of a globalized world in the 21st century. What kind of decisions should we make? And are we going to be smart enough to get these decisions and make them stick? I think that's the challenge for the United States. And I think that's what President Obama was talking about throughout his campaign. And he's been talking about it for the first 30 days of his presidency. He has an extraordinary amount of weight on his shoulders. If you think about what's happening in our country, and everybody here knows it and feels it with all the problems that we're confronting. So I thought I would, just to get the discussion started, try to say, what's the good news? What can we rely on as strengths for our society and country and indeed the world as we look ahead? And what's the bad news? What are the big challenges? It's 8:30 on a Saturday morning. You're all nice enough to come out to this opera house. I'll give you the good news first. I think that President Obama, as commander-in-chief and president, can rely on three metrics of power that will be the foundation of America's relationship with the rest of the world. And they're very obvious. The first is military. We're still the strongest military in the world. We will remain the strongest military power for as far into the future as we can see. There's no combination of powers that can approach us in terms of military power, the ability to deploy that power around the world, the ability to sustain it. What we've done since 9/11 in deploying 33,000 troops to Afghanistan, keeping them there since October of 2001. And now going to add another 17,000, Obama announced this week. We've deployed 150,000 men and women to Iraq and have sustained them there. And I think the story of our time, Iraq, Afghanistan, and before that in the Clinton administration, Bosnia and Kosovo, is that our men and women have been absolutely superb on the battlefield. And they've done us proud. And they've protected us as much as they can from the evils that surround us. So we have military power. The next 10 to 15 countries combined don't spend as much on their military defense as we do. And that's a unique asset in a violent age, in a troubling age, where there are dangers out there that we need to protect ourselves from. Second dimension of power is political. When Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State, she said, we're the indispensable country. And a lot of the Europeans said, that sounds arrogant. She said, no, it's not arrogant. We're the indispensable country because whether countries, peoples like us or not, and there is a fair amount of anti-Americanism in the world, when times are tough, when they have problems, they call on us. So if you think about some of the things that have been happening around the world, problems between China and Taiwan for the last 20 years, the United States at times has been a sort of mediator between those two. For 61 years now, we've been a mediator, not always very successful, in fact, not ever ultimately successful, between the Palestinians and the Israelis. When the Mumbai terrorist attacks occurred in November, who was the first foreign leader to visit Delhi and Islamabad? Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. So countries, whether they like American power or not, whether they respect us, whether they feel pro-American or anti-American, they look to us for political leadership. We are a factor. We are the strongest factor in the political fabric of the world, and I think that will remain a source of our power in the future. Third dimension, third bit of good news, is that my colleague Joe Nye at Harvard wrote a book called Soft Power. It really does exist as an element in international politics. I know that from my own career in diplomacy. It's the combination of our values, of the attractiveness and strength of our businesses, particularly of our universities and our non-governmental institutions. It's our national story of immigration and acceptance and tolerance that makes us attractive. We're not the only country in the world that has soft power. Most countries have soft power. We have a lot of it. It tends to be universal because we're an international society. And so that's an element of our power. It can be a form of diplomatic power. I would say we need to rely on this more. Not rely on it totally, because the world's too violent for that. We can't be naive. But it needs to be seen by us as citizens and certainly by our leaders as an element of our national power. I heard Obama saying that in the campaign trail. I hear him saying that in the first month of his presidency. I'm encouraged by it. That's all the good news I can think of on this Saturday morning. Now, here's the bad news. You know, imagine that President Obama called one of you, or all of you, and said, I'd like to see you tomorrow morning in the Roosevelt Room, just off the Oval Office. I've been focused on the stimulus package, on the mortgage bailout, on the bank bailout, on all the other bailouts. I need to turn my attention for a couple of hours Sunday morning, tomorrow morning, to foreign policy, the international landscape. What would you tell him if you had 15 or 20 minutes to talk to President Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden? What would you say to them? I want you to think about that. Because when it comes to the question and answer, maybe Graham and I will pose the question to you and ask you what you think. Here's what I'd say. I'd say, Mr. President, there is all this good news that I just detailed, but there's a lot of bad news too. And the first bad news is, I'd say, remember I talked about the positive metrics of our power? Well, I'm going to start the bad news with a negative metric of our power. It's the economy. And it's our economic foundation here at home. And it's our economic prosperity globally. And we're in trouble. And the foundations of our country have been shaking since September 16th, 2008, when the trouble became most apparent. And if I had to choose one metric that is absolutely indispensable for a country's power, it's not the military and political and soft power, it's economic power. Because I don't think we can sustain a fully engaged, active, energetic, and successful foreign and defense policy on behalf of our country if we've got double-digit unemployment, and if millions of people are losing their homes, and if there's no hope or even certainty about what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. It'll affect the psyche of the American people as they look out in the world, and we've already begun to see that. We've seen elements of both isolationism coming back. It's never really left us in our 232 years as a country. We've seen elements of protectionism written into the stimulus package, and you've seen the outcry around the world about that. And so I say to the president, obviously this is the most important issue, he knows this, before you and before the American people. It's going to be 90% of your presidency. It's going to define the first 100 days, the first year. It may define whether or not there's a second term for the Obama administration. And I say that as someone who feels very supportive of what President Obama is trying to do. So that is the first bit of bad news. The second is that I can't remember a time as a former diplomat, now someone teaching diplomacy and politics, international politics, I can't remember a time when we've had such a forbidding international agenda in this country. I mean, think of the agenda that President Obama has inherited. Two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where there really is no end in sight yet. We don't have an established withdrawal schedule in Iraq. General Scowcroft said last night And I respect him and his experience. We shouldn't have one. That's so obvious at this point. We have a war in Afghanistan, which many people believe will become the crucible for President Obama, the way Iraq was for President Bush. We're not winning in Afghanistan. And we have to figure out a counterinsurgency strategy that can be successful. Naya and Chandra and I were talking about this on the long drive from Logan to Camden yesterday. He'll speak to you later on today. How difficult this is to put together a humanitarian assistance, rule of law program to help the people of the villages of Afghanistan to turn away from the Taliban and to support the government. It's an extraordinarily difficult task for our troops, for our aid workers, and for our diplomats. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Climate change. 2009 will be a defining year. As the Obama administration says, we're going to dive into it. You've got another expert here in Paula Dobriansky, who's been doing a lot of our negotiating. She'll speak to you as well. And she's a real expert on climate change. Think of the threat of pandemics. Think of the fact that the World Bank is forecasting food shortages and a 50% increase in the demand of food in the world by 2025. Think of the fact that terrorism is still with us, that international crime cartels and drug cartels are still with us, that trafficking of women and children is a scourge around the globe. And I've just named, what, 7, 8, 9 issues. I think if we spent 2 minutes and went around the room, we'd come up with 20 or 25 issues. And so I'd say to President Obama, if I had the chance, if you had the chance, what a daunting foreign policy agenda he faces. That's the second bit of bad news. Here's the third. Other countries are gaining on us. Our unipolar moment that Charles Krauthammer talked about, roughly between, say, the fall of the Soviet Union, Christmas Day 91, and maybe 9/11, it's over. We were supremely powerful during that window of time. A lot of us in this room served in the U.S. government during that time. It was a remarkable time of strength for us and purpose and opportunity. But it's over because China and Brazil and India are becoming global powers. And Mexico and South Africa and Nigeria and Indonesia are certainly regional powers. And they have more ability to influence things in the world. That's going to affect the way Americans see the world, the way we operate in it. It's going to limit some of our possibilities. It may expand others. And the fourth thing I'd say to President Obama is that there's something normative, too, that is going to be a problem for you. It's about Americans and how we view the world. Are we going to be able to, are you going to be able to motivate the United States, the American people, at this time of great stress at home, to continue to go out and do the things we have to do and spend the money that we're going to have to spend to be successful in the world? And our national history is a little bit checkered. As Brent said last night, we've been a little bit ambivalent as a people. As we look out in the world, it goes all the way back to the founding fathers and the debates that they had about whether we should have a central bank and a strong government and compete with the Europeans, or whether we should, as Jefferson said, essentially perfect our pure democracy at home. Whether we should go out and expand the country and think of ourselves as an empire, or whether we should, as John Quincy Adams famously said, not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. I mean, this argument is all throughout our history. Teddy Roosevelt and President Charles Eliot of Harvard debated whether we should be an empire. I think President Eliot lost that debate because we became an imperial power in acquiring the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. Who was the most popular American of the 1930s? I think it was probably Charles A. Lindbergh. What was he doing in the 30s? My dad told me about this. He was going around to Boston Garden and Madison Square Garden saying, that's not our fight in Europe. That's not our fight against the fascist powers. And I think, luckily, we had a president, FDR, who eventually said, it certainly is our fight. When I was State Department spokesman, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee decided to cut our dues to the United Nations in half. We have another real expert here in the UN, Kristen Silverberg, who was our Assistant Secretary of State, charge of UN Affairs, recently Ambassador to the EU. And, you know, she and I worked to try to build up U.S. support for the UN. But back in the 90s, our dues were cut in half. And Madeleine Albright said to Senator Jesse Helms, you know, we've got to pay our dues. We're the founding country, we're the host country, and we're the lead donor. And if we don't pay our full 100% dues, what kind of message is that to the rest of the world about our commitment to what most people around the world say is the supreme international organization, despite all of its troubles and weaknesses, the United Nations. So this fourth bit of bad news is, what choice are we going to make in the 21st century when we face all these problems at home? Will we be willing to go out and be energetic and ambitious and engaged in the world and not try to withdraw from the world as we have so often, or as some would have, well, some thought we should, you know, kind of go it alone, be unilaterally? I think both isolation and unilateralism are recipes for failure in our foreign policy. So that's a lot of bad news to give the president on one morning. How do we think about getting out of the mess that we're in, digging out of the hole that we're in? Well, to start the conversation, I'd suggest a couple of things. First, getting back to economics, recognizing that there's been a huge transfer of power from Wall Street to Pennsylvania Avenue. I mean, if you think about it, when the Senate and House passed the first bailout package of what was it, $750 billion back in October, that just didn't transfer money, it transferred power from the financial institutions in New York to the President, the Secretary of Treasury, and the Congress. And we haven't had so much power now invested in Washington politicians and bureaucrats, I think, since the New Deal. And I'm not opposed to this because I can't see any alternative but for the federal government now to step up and play a big role in the economy as President Obama has suggested. But here's the problem. Will we get the balance right? And I'm someone who believes in government, was very proud of my own service in government, ability to serve, and thinks that government can be a positive agent in our society. But can government do the right things to protect us from the financial problems we're in, but also not suffocate the business sector, not take away risk, not take away the ambition that ultimately is going to bring us out of this, at some point, we hope, economic hole that we're in? And I think getting that balance right, which is going to be exceedingly difficult for the President and the Secretary of the Treasury and the Speaker of the House, getting that balance right. Regulating, we have to regulate. We probably shouldn't, in hindsight, have dismantled FDR's entire regulatory legacy. That began in the Reagan administration, continued through the Clinton administration, onto the Bush administration. So when we re-regulate, can we do so in such a way that preserves some of the best part of what the private sector is going to need to help us all become prosperous again? I think that's a big historical shift to think about of power, and I hope our government can get it right. Second thing I'd say in a prescriptive sense, what should we do, is to recognize that there's another big shift that I talked about before, the shift of political power around the world. Now, if you're a zero-sum thinking person, if you think that when China gains, we loses, we lose. Let me try that again. When China gains, we lose. So when the Chinese become more powerful militarily, we must become less powerful. If the Indian high-tech sector grows, we have to lose. There are certain people who look at it that way, who think that maybe we're back in the Cold War, when a zero-sum mentality might have been more appropriate and rational. But if you look at it a different way, and I have a suspicion that President Obama, because of his life experience, because of his travels and orientation, sees it in the second way. If we see it as glass half full, not glass half empty, then we can see that the rise of these other powers is not necessarily a bad thing for the United States. Think of it this way. There's no global governing board of the world, but there's a virtual global governing board of the world. We're on it. Japan's on it. European Union countries are on it. We need to invite China to become a full member, and India and Brazil, at least, and some of the other countries that I talked about. We need to say to them, in addition to your corporate board seat, there are annual dues. And there are expectations that you'll serve on committees so that your troops will do more of the peacekeeping of the type that our troops have been doing. And you'll pay for more of those UN peacekeeping operations in Africa that we have been principally paying for. And that, you know, President Bush gave you a pretty good lead, China, India, Brazil. He put $30 billion into an HIV/AIDS long-term program in Haiti and Southern Africa. You should do things like that, too. If you think of all the problems that we face, none of them can be resolved by the U.S. acting alone, and none of them can be resolved by the U.S. staying at home. So we're going to have to look for partners and countries to help us. And I think if we look positively at the rise of China, India, and Brazil, ask them to be more responsible, more involved, and if we are more collaborative with them, this trend of power being more diffuse in the world need not be negative for the United States. It need not be something that weakens us. I actually think it can strengthen us. And as General Scowcroft suggested last night, we then need to look at the international institutions and say, don't they need to be reformed? The United Nations Security Council is the Security Council of 1945. It's the world of Chiang Kai-shek, Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, Charles de Gaulle. It's their world, but it's not our world. And a Security Council without India as a full member, without Brazil as a full member, without Japan, the second largest donor to the UN system on it, without a single African country represented, not a single one, as a permanent member, that kind of Security Council can't be legitimate or credible, in my judgment, in the 21st century. So this can be a positive story for the United States. That's the second prescriptive point I'd make. Third, we have to be global. We're a global superpower. We have to be active in Latin America, Africa, Europe, East Asia. But I guess I'd say if you have to choose, and to govern is to choose, you have to choose, you have to prioritize. There are two regions of the world that are going to write the history of our foreign policy more or less in the next 10 years, and that's the Middle East, and you'll hear from Tamara about the Middle East, and that's South Asia. I mean, that's where the fires are burning. In the last 100 years, they were mainly burning in Europe. That's why we had to be focused on Europe, First World War, Second World War, Cold War, Balkan Wars. But right now, it's the Middle East and South Asia. It's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I agree with General Scowcroft. We need to be an active mediator. It's the challenge that Iran poses to the balance of power in the Middle East, and that's a very serious, profound challenge. It's the Iraq War. Can we end it well? Can we leave but not destabilize the country? And increasingly, it's the problems of South Asia. Nan and I were talking again yesterday. No American would have said at the Camden Conference 10 years ago today, South Asia is vital to the United States. It is now. It's vital to the United States. Because we have this war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, which is going to become the real test. It's where the Taliban are. It's where Al-Qaeda is. We have a friend in Pakistan that is a nuclear-armed country, a government that does not control a great deal of its own country, a government with nuclear weapons, and a government hosting some of the most vicious terrorist groups in the world that are pointed at us. And it's the inability of the Pakistani government to get at the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that allows those two groups to cross the border and to make life miserable for our forces and the Afghan forces and the European forces there. It's a huge challenge. And maybe the biggest immediate challenge, maybe even bigger and more immediate than the Middle East challenge for the Obama administration. A lot of bad news. One glimmer of positive news in South Asia. We're constructing with India an enormously positive relationship. This was begun by President Clinton. It was continued by President Bush. India will soon be the largest country in the world by population. It's a democracy. It's relatively stable, as stable as a billion-person democracy can possibly be. We and the Indians share strategic interests in South and East Asia. We are coming together militarily and politically. And as if anyone here is in business, and I assume a lot of you are, the trade investment growth in this relationship is truly promising. One statistic. One of every seven startups in Silicon Valley is an Indian or an Indian American. So we have bridges that connect us to India that make that a singularly bright story in otherwise a very troubled region. So I'd say to the president, South Asia and the Middle East will be and must be your focus. Last thing I'd say is this. It sounds like an Obama campaign slogan. Hope, not fear. And I think the president has internalized this. We lead at a time when we have to project a positive image of our country and a positive image of our intentions and strategic ambitions to the rest of the world. And so if the rest of the world believes that poverty and social justice are important, and the people in the Andes believe that, and in Haiti, then we have to stand up for those values. We have to say it, and we have to mean it and help them. if most of the people of the world would say that climate change is the most important pressing issue, and many people say that in Europe, then we have to be in the middle of that debate, and Paula will talk about how we might do that, I'm sure, in the coming months. I just think our greatest presidents have been those presidents, Democrats and Republicans, that at times of really great challenge didn't project fear, but projected hope and a positive spirit. Woodrow Wilson did for a time in 1917, 18, and 19 until the great disaster of our failure to join the League of Nations. FDR certainly did with his four freedoms. Ronald Reagan did when he said people shouldn't have to live under communist regimes. They should be able to live in freedom. And my sense is, as an American, that Barack Obama has this potential as a leader in the way he addressed the world in his inaugural speech, in the El Arabiya interview, in some of the very positive things that he's done, some of them symbolic but important for the rest of the world, saying Senator Mitchell's going out on a listening tour, as Brent said last night. Hillary Clinton said she was on a listening tour. A lot of her activities in Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, and China were highly symbolic, I thought highly appropriate, not just to go and meet the leaders, but to go out and reach the people and to project an image of an America that wants to contribute to the global good. I think that's probably the key test for us and for our president. We're so big and powerful. You know, McDonald's and Starbucks are on every street corner around the world. The U.S. military is everywhere. We're kind of so present that people want to know that this strong global superpower actually is going to contribute to the global good. So if we're the largest carbon emitter with China, we've got to be seen to be contributing a solution to climate change. And if we have been, since 9/11, if we've launched two military invasions of foreign countries, we've now got to be seen to be part of the healing process and rebuilding process of those societies after the wars that we were forced to fight. And I think this is this element of projecting hope and positive strength that is Obama's greatest challenge and greatest opportunity. So those are some thoughts from me as to how we might think about what's going well, what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses, what are some prescriptive things that we could do to try to maintain the strength of our country, because I do believe that the world needs positive, strong American leadership. I'm not an isolationist. I'm certainly not a unilateralist, but we have to be engaged in the world. And I wish our president and the new administration all the best. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was great. Thank you.
We're listening to a presentation by former Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns from the 2009 Camden Conference here on Voices on WERU-FM. After his prepared talk, Professor Burns took questions from the audience, moderated by Graham Faup.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. That was really a wonderful panorama of the issues that the new administration faces, and not without hope, but certainly some sobering issues for us to deal with. So let's open it for questions here. And we have one at the front of the auditorium, number one, Mike. And if, again, you could announce
Charles Cogan, Kennedy School. That was a remarkable performance. I detected one false note, however, and that was the phrase, the wars we were forced to fight. Do you include Iraq in that? I don't.
You know, we sat together at dinner. I thought you'd toss me a softball this morning. It'd be so tough on me. Well, here's what I think. I think that it was absolutely necessary to launch the invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001. I think it was a close call, my own view, in 2003. I think you have to also, you have to put yourself in the shoes of our national leadership post-2001. I know you probably have tried to do that. It was a shock, 9/11. We felt there was a strong possibility of future actions. And so I think that led to 2001 and 2002. My own view is that if we had to roll, if we could roll back the clock, roll back the reel of the film, I think going into Iraq was a mistake in 2003. I don't think it was worth the national effort ultimately the national sacrifice that we had to undertake. But I know that we're there now, and I just hope that we can establish a drawdown that will be responsible. And I was struck by what Brent said last night. You know, he didn't think we should establish an affirm, explicit, clear public timetable at this point. And that's going to be an early challenge to the Obama administration. It gets to a point that I didn't mention, and it has to do with diplomacy. We have three elements of national power: the military, intelligence, and diplomacy. I don't want to weaken the first two in a dangerous world. I certainly want to strengthen the third. I think at times in our reaction to 9/11, and I'm not trying to be critical of President Bush here, because it's hard to be president, and I've never been president. I can imagine the responsibilities that were on his shoulders after 9/11. But I think that we tended, for the first couple of years after 9/11, to lead with the military. And now we're in a time when, and I think a lot of military officers would tell you this, we have to lead with diplomacy. We have to think of diplomacy as our first line of offense, and the military as the backup, rather than the other way around. And I worry about that, because I left the State Department last spring. The State Department needs help. The State Department is underfunded, as is USAID. We have 6,500 active diplomats in the world. So there are more lawyers in the Pentagon than there are American diplomats. There are more musicians in the armed forces bands, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, than there are American diplomats. And people like Paula and Kristen and I, who just came out of the government, can tell you, we have great people in the State Department, in the career and civil service, our political appointees, but we don't have enough of them. Secretary Rice went to the Congress last year, about a year ago, and said, I need 1,200 new officers in the state and 300 new aid officers, and she didn't get anything. It was an election year. The bill didn't go anywhere. I hope President Obama and Secretary Clinton can convince the Congress. We need a bigger diplomatic corps. We need a rebuilt USAID if, in fact, we've got to lead with diplomacy. And so thank you for giving me the opportunity to answer that question.
We're going to move upstairs to mic three and then come down to mic three, mic two after that.
Thank you very much for the good presentation, Ambassador Nicholas Byrne. My name is Hastin Bhakti, and I'm from Washington, D.C. You talk about the needs for the United States to bring all the influential economies to be on board. So I remember that last year, United States was hosting a G20 summit in Washington, D.C., and this year, London will be hosting the next summit. I think this G20 summit could become one of the most important forums, because it consists of 20 countries that comes from all five continents in the world. It could be very practical, because 20 countries, and of course EU is there, the IMF, the World Bank are also invited. I think that this G20 summit could be one of the most strategic forum that could be used to deal with a lot of global issues other than economies. So what do you think about the prospect of this G20 summit, and is there any possibility that the new administration will encourage or develop this gathering or forum into a more solid and structured and institutionalized forum for taking or for dealing with the global issues? Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a great question, and it speaks to what General Scowcroft said last night and one of the points I mentioned, and that is that we need new institutions to combat these modern problems, and the G20 is a great example of that. You all remember the G7? The G7 was created in the 1970s. Who's in the G7? The U.S., Canada, Japan, and several European countries. That's the G7. And they said in the 1970s, we are the greatest economic powers in the world. We'll meet once a year in the G7 summit, and we will decide the great macroeconomic decisions of the world. When President Sarkozy, I read in the New York Times, suggested just after our elections that the G7 should meet, this is November 08, to discuss our crisis, I was really proud when President Bush said, well, actually, it should be the G20. Because how can we meet and resolve this crisis without our largest creditor? We're the largest debtor, China. Without Brazil, without India, without South Africa, without Mexico. So the G20 is a 21st century institution, as opposed to a 1970s institution? It's a great question because I think one of the key issues for 2009 and 10 will be, can this larger, more amorphous group be successful in agreeing on common global strategies to combat or to resolve these massive financial and economic problems that we have? But it's certainly the better group. And I think it was good that first President Bush, then President Obama said, that's the group. It wasn't obvious to some of the European countries that that would be the group, but it is the group. And they're meeting, I believe, in early April in London. President Obama will be there before he goes to the 60th anniversary NATO summit. So that will be a very consequential meeting for him. What I heard General Scowcroft saying last night was, you've got to create these new institutions and then see if they can work. And that second part of it is very important in government. Ideas are important. Creating something is, but making it effective and work is probably more important in the long run.
Thank you.
Moving over to mic number two here.
My name is Eddie Harrow from Bangor, Maine, and I'd like to pose a question that I think relates to much of the problems and issues that you've been outlining, and that is, why hasn't there been more discussion about the issue of population growth?
I don't know if it's on the agenda for this conference.
We've certainly dealt with population growth at other conferences, and it's a very germane question, but it's not particularly on our agenda at the moment.
Right, and I'm not going to be able to give you a great answer. I'm not an expert on this. But I have two conflicting opposed thoughts that will sound contradictory, but maybe make up some of the opinion worldwide in this issue. On the one hand, obviously, population growth rates are highly injurious in many parts of the developing world, especially when you look at the Global Trends 2025 report by the National Intelligence Council. If you haven't seen that, you can go on the NIC web and get it. It does predict these massive increases in the demand for food and water and possible resource wars over them and over energy as we go ahead. That's forbidding, and part of that obviously is tied to population growth. Here's the contrary thought. If you look at, and there's been a lot of many interesting articles in this in recent weeks, look at who might win and who might lose because of the current economic crisis. Those countries that are bringing people into their populations that have higher immigration rates, like the United States, might be better off in the longer term than some of the old, rather more sclerotic European societies, just given the number of people who will be on the welfare Medicaid rolls in those countries 20 to 30 years from now. And so there's an argument being made by a lot of economists that actually higher population growth rates might help on a macroeconomic sense in the industrialized world. Those are opposite contradictory thoughts. Or maybe they make up part of the complexity of the issue of population.
It is a very complex issue, and we run a conference on that whole topic, and someone on the board could perhaps refer you to the findings of that conference at that particular time. Actually, we're going to move to one of our satellite sites now. There's a question that's going to come up on our screen from Jane Grossbaum in Belfast. If the permanent membership of the UNSC is increased as it should be, what would you suggest doing about the veto power enjoyed by the five permanent members?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm looking right at Kristen Silverberg because she and I had to deal with this issue when we were in government. My sense is that the countries that wish to come on, India, Brazil, Japan, South Africa, maybe Nigeria in the future, understand that the veto power probably won't change in the short run. If there is a change in the composition of the Security Council, it would be unwieldy and perhaps disastrous for the effectiveness of the Council if more countries had the veto. And so my sense would be that it would be logical to maintain the veto where it is. Another question is, is Europe overrepresented on the Security Council? There are five permanent members, three of which are European right now, Russia, Britain, and France. And some countries, usually outside of Europe, have suggested, well, why doesn't there just be one European seat and one European veto? Europeans don't like that
because we can't speak with one voice.
At least, well, as Graham said, you can't speak with one voice. Exactly right. But I think if you're British or French, you might not like that.
Probably not.
It'd take away your veto. So it's a complicated issue. It takes 128 votes in the General Assembly to change the charter. It's enormous. It's variable geometry. For all the countries that want to be on, there's a group that arises to block them. So Italy is not really enthusiastic about Germany coming on, and Argentina is not enthusiastic about Brazil coming on. You can see the regional power rivalries. So it's a complicated question, but I don't think we can shrink from it. I think we have to recreate and modernize these institutions to make them effective.
We're going to move over to mic number one here.
Good morning, and thank you. Dwight Leeper from Westfield, New Jersey. One of the difficulties of globalization and our growth and rising economic desires is the need for raw materials, oil, metals, potash, fertilizers, and so forth. Those are, of course, in some greater scheme, limited materials, and they're leading to the rise increasingly of what I might term commodity despots, such as Venezuela, perhaps, or perhaps Russia, perhaps some in the Middle East. How would you advise President Obama to deal with countries where diplomacy is less important because they control natural resources that are in increasing demand around the world?
Thank you. That's actually a very large and compelling question for the international political scene these days. I guess I'd say two things. First, we've got to get our own house in order and have a comprehensive energy strategy for our country, which hopefully gets us less reliant on the carbon economy and more reliant on... I'm for nuclear power, but I'm also for civil nuclear power, but I'm also for alternative energy sources. And he talked about that in the campaign. I guess the question will be, where is that as a priority, given everything else he's got to do? How much political capital can he spend on that? It's going to be very difficult with the Congress, given everything else he has to do. Second thought is, I think that people like Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Putin and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, leaders of three of these commodity economies, energy economies, need to think very hard about how they operate in the world. When oil was at $140 a barrel last summer, they were riding high. Now that it's, you know, what is it now? In the low 40s, they're not riding so high. They're not doing so well. Chavez did win that election. He became, I guess, president for life on Sunday. But Venezuela's ability to be active and effective in the Americas is directly linked to how much that price of oil is. And that's the same is true with Russia, same is true with Iran. They've got to think of their national strength in a more comprehensive way. And they have to practice a little bit of diplomacy. You don't see much coming from either of those three governments right now. So there were a lot of predictions 6 months ago, 8 months ago, that the coming wave were these countries because of their energy power. Doesn't look like that right now. There was an amazing moment the first weekend of October, just after the first 2 weeks of the shocks last autumn, the financial shocks, when Putin and Medvedev, the prime minister and president of Russia, gave back-to-back press conferences that I read about in the New York Times, and the press conferences went like this from both of them. It was obviously the same set of talking points. Well, we're looking at the events in New York and in Wall Street, and we're so proud of our own system. That kind of thing is not going to happen here. There are weaknesses in the American system. And I thought to myself, these guys don't understand they live in a globalized world. And within 3 to 4 weeks, the Russian stock market had lost two-thirds of its value because, you know, the flu on Wall Street spread to Moscow, as we knew it would. And so I think one of the problems, particularly in Russia, if you want to talk about Russia, is I think the Russian leadership has the old zero-sum framework for how to govern. I'm not sure they're fully in the 21st century mode. And what they've been doing, crossing the border into Georgia last August, which was a big mistake, and then the outright threats to the Europeans and Ukrainians on the gas supplies just 6 weeks ago, another indication that they're playing a brand of power politics that I'm not sure is going to be ultimately effective in the 21st century. So I'd say those countries need to practice diplomacy just as we do.
Thank you. We're going to move upstairs to mic number three now.
I'm John Davidson from Camden, Maine. And my question is this. This morning's New York Times reported that the Obama administration had really was expanding its military operations in Pakistan. In the past, as you had said, I think it targeted Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but now it's also targeting organizations that would topple the Pakistani government. And my question for you is what does this tell us about sort of the future direction of the Obama administration in terms of its activities?
Thank you. Well, obviously, the Obama administration is focused on two regions. On his second day in office, he went to the State Department and, along with Secretary Clinton, announced the appointment of two envoys. These were the first sub-cabinet appointments, George Mitchell from Maine to the Middle East, Richard Holbrooke to South Asia. I thought they were spectacular appointments. These are two of the best, toughest, most experienced negotiators that we have in our country. It's also an indication that the new American administration, like the Bush administration, sees those two regions as the most critical. Very different regions. In South Asia, I guess I'd say you'll hear a lot from Nayan today, and he's a real expert on this, that I think you have to consider that you're really fighting, the conflict is in Afghanistan, Pakistan. It's not just in Afghanistan. And my own view, and I could be wrong about this, is that while the military adding troops can be helpful in the short term, it's not going to be the resolution of the problem. It's a village-based and tribal-based society. It's the country with the poorest infrastructure in the world. There are enormous problems in the countryside. And I think we have to think of USAID and the NGOs as playing a big role in the solution alongside our military, as General Petraeus was able to do really brilliantly in Iraq, combine the military with the humanitarian, economic, and an effective counterinsurgency strategy. That seems to me to be the big test for the U.S., the Europeans, and the rest of the international community in Afghanistan.
We've now got a question from one of our satellite venues, and then we'll move over to Mike 2. From Michael Weigrant, Weigand at Portland. Where do U.S.-Russian relations fit into the scenario of the 21st century that you have outlined?
Thank you. I think that this is going to be one of the more complicated relationships for the new American administration, obviously. Russia's back. Russia's trying to show us it's back. Putin is governing internally with a crackdown on the press, on civil rights, in limiting Russian democracy very differently than President Yeltsin did. And he's certainly governing in terms of his foreign policy in a much more aggressive way. So what do we do? I don't have all the answers, but I guess I'd say we need to have a balance of interests here. On the one hand, we need Russia on counterterrorism. We need Russia on counterproliferation. If we're going to be successful in convincing North Korea and Iran not to become permanent nuclear powers, in the case of North Korea, not to become a nuclear power in the case of Iran, Russia is a critical, critical factor. Russia has influence with both those countries, particularly Iran, as General Scowcroft suggested. We need to have a relationship with Russia on energy because it's such a profound power, given its oil and gas reserves. So I can't see us going back into a Cold War where we don't talk to the Russians. I can't see us saying, you know, we're just going to try to contain the Russians in the 21st century. That won't work. We have to work with them. And that means that at some points, we'll have to compromise. We won't get everything our way. During our unipolar moment in the 90s, you know, we didn't always have to do that. But power is flatter now. We'll have to do more of that. On the other hand, here's where the balance comes in. And I spoke to a group of Russian generals at Harvard 2 weeks ago, and at the end of my remarks, they said, "You're a hawk." I said, "Well, thank you. That really is going to help my image in the United States. It really will help my image in the United States." So thank you for calling me a hawk. But what I said to them was, I said, okay, we have to cooperate on those three areas. I said, but here's where you're going to have a problem with the United States, I hope. If you think you can recreate your sphere of influence that you impose militarily on the Baltic states in 1940, on the peoples of Central and Eastern Europe between 1945 and 1991, and if you think you're going to impose a permanent Russian sphere of influence in the Caucasus and Central Asia, we're not going to go along with that. I think, you know, look, remember when the first President Bush, when the Cold War ended, he said, we're trying to establish a democratic peace in Europe. And we Americans have a big responsibility for that along with our European allies. If Georgia ultimately wants to join the EU and NATO, it should at least have the right to apply. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the right to decide whether they commit or not and when. But they have the right to apply and not to think that their future is to be a vassal of a greater Russia. Mm-hmm. And the same has to be true of Azerbaijan and of Kazakhstan. And the same should certainly be true of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania that are now NATO allies. They were forcibly incorporated for 50 years into the Soviet Empire. So my personal view is we've got to be very tough with the Russians, tough-minded, not tough go-to-war, not tough bring about a military conflict, but stand up for the principles that free people should be able to determine their futures. And countries should not be able to impose in a way that's intimidating their view of those countries' futures. And I think that's where the balance comes in. Cooperation with Russia, yes, but standing true to democratic principles, I think that's part of our foreign policy too. And now, how do you get those two halves right? How do you make the two halves work? That's where diplomacy comes in. That's where the president will be tested on this.
Microphone number two here in the auditorium.
Yeah, I'm Mitchell Tomashow. I'm the president of Unity College in Maine. Last week at this time, I was at the Clinton Global Initiative University in Austin, Texas. There are over 1,000 students from 60 countries and 80 college presidents all gathered to deal with a whole range of international service issues. And the soft power that was accumulated there was truly magnificent. We saw students who were involved in poverty alleviation, healthcare, climate change and sustainability, and a whole range of issues. And the commitments that they generate are brilliant and evocative and truly inspiring. I wonder if, am I naive to think that this soft power, perhaps, can be a really powerful influence in international politics and that we're underestimating its potential?
Oh, I agree with you. I don't think the soft power can become the policy of the United States. It is a part of who we are and what we represent. But I agree with you. We have enormous strengths in this society. I see it at the university where I teach at Harvard. 45% of our student body is international. We could fill 100% of our slots with superb people from all over the world. People want to come here. They want to come to our universities. They want to be part of our society. Look at the people who want to immigrate still to our country. So relying on that as part of what we do in the world, I think, yes, I agree with you. But I guess I'm enough of a realist to think that we need a strong military. We need strong intelligence. We need a strong hard edge to our foreign and defense policy, too, because it is a dangerous world. It's the combination, bringing them together, integrating them, which I think that alchemy can be important and an important added benefit to our foreign policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, indeed. That was great.
We've been listening to a presentation by Professor and former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Nicholas Burns, from the 2009 Camden Conference. The conference's theme was Global Leadership and the U.S. Role in World Affairs. WERU will be broadcasting more of the presentations from the conference in the weeks ahead. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to www.weru.org and click on Audio Archives. If you'd like more information on the Camden Conference, go to www.camdenconference.org. Thanks very much for listening to this special edition of Voices.